Hey, Peter Sagal here. I know you're probably expecting to hear us make hilarious jokes about the week's news. But it is 4th of July weekend, and that means Carl Castle is hosting his huge summer barbecue, an annual bacchanal that's Woodstock meets Burning Man mixed with a little Antiques Roadshow. Anyway, today we have a show you may have missed that takes a look at events from the past and proves that the more things change, the more they stay strange. Enjoy.
From NPR and Chicago Public Radio, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Carl Castle, and here's your host at Memorial Hall on the campus of the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, Carl. Thank you very much. Sometimes the news of the week gets so unpleasant, so difficult to contemplate, that we seek refuge in the comforting stories of the past. Inevitably, we come running back to the present, weeping with gratitude, just like Jimmy Stewart at the end of It's a Wonderful Life. But we did, of course, bring back some questions for you and for our panel. It's a quick trip through the lowlights of history on this week's show, and of course, every time a bell rings, an angel gets his wings. Time to welcome our first listener to the show. The number is 1-888-WAIT-WAIT. Hi, you're on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Hi, this is Britt calling from Attica, Indiana.
Attica?
Yes.
But Indiana.
Not Attica. Okay.
Not New York.
No, you're not incarcerated.
No,
we could tell because it wasn't a collect call. Britt, what do you do there in Attica?
I am an intern Lutheran pastor.
An intern to be a
Lutheran pastor? Yes, I am in seminary and I'm studying to be a pastor.
What does the intern have to do for the pastor?
Well,
oh, Lord.
Well, you know, it's partially our fault because we basically went to town on that for about a year. But intern has become a dirty word, and I now want to bring it back. So I'm sure
in
you
certain
have,
faith, pastor's not a barrel of laughs
yeah,
at this
I guess
point.
So. But I'm sure your duties are all wholesome and useful, right?
Yes.
Okay. Well, welcome to our show, Britt. Let me introduce you to our panel this week. First, say hello to Boston Globe writer Mr. Charlie Pierce.
Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Britt.
Also say hello to a Washington Post style section reporter and one of the co-authors of the reliable source for that paper, Ms. Roxanne Roberts.
Hi, Roxanne.
Hi. Do casseroles figure in what you have to do at all?
For other people, yes, not for me. I'm vegetarian.
Ah.
That would be good if for a Lutheran pastor they give you 2 boxes of Jell-O and a can of pineapple and they see what you do.
Yes, exactly. Liturgically correct colored Jell-O.
And lastly, say hello to a humorist and the author of Feet on the Street, Rambles Around New Orleans, Mr. Roy Blunt, Jr.
Hi, Roy.
Hey, Brett. Short for Brittany?
No.
Oh, okay.
Good Swedish Lutheran.
Oh, good. So Reverend Brittany just wouldn't go too well, would it?
No.
Brett, welcome to the show. Now, you're going to play Who's Carl This Time, with which we traditionally start our show. But this week's a little different. Instead of the week's news, all of your quotes right now are statements from history that the speaker came to regret sooner or later. Ready to play?
Yes.
All right, here is your first statement that maybe was not so wise.
His full cockroach mustache hints a laughter benigning, and the shafts of his boots always spotlessly shining.
That was an excerpt from a poem by the Russian poet Osip Mandelstam. Turns out he really should not have decided to make fun of the quote, cockroach mustache of whom?
Stalin?
Yes.
But I like it. Carl, can you read that couplet again, please?
Sure. His full cockroach mustache hints a laughter benigning, and the shafts of his boots always spotlessly shine.
Am I crazy, or does that sound like the communist version of The Night Before Christmas?
With Stalin as Jolly
Yes,
saying
exactly.
That. Well, in addition to the classic rules of not pulling on Superman's cape and spitting into the wind, you do not make fun of Uncle Joe's mustache. For offenses against the great leader's facial hair, Mr. Mandelstam was sent to Siberia.
Where, ironically, he saw Santa Claus off every year.
Yes. All right, here's your next quote.
The policeman isn't there to create disorder. The policeman is there to preserve disorder.
That was a big city mayor speaking back in 1968 as his police did a bang-up job preserving disorder in the streets. Do you know the mayor?
No, I was born in 74.
Oh, well, all right. We'll make it a little easier for you. We'll just ask you for the city. What city was it back in 1968 where the police were creating disorder?
Oh, it wasn't Chicago at the Democratic, whatchamacallit, was it?
Yes, you're right. It was, in fact.
Oh, so it was Daley?
It was Daley.
Oh, yes. Good.
Mayor Daley was proud that his city was hosting the Democratic presidential convention that year. He didn't want any no-good, long-haired hippies ruining it. So he sent the cops out into the streets to disabuse people of their unsocial notions by repeatedly striking them in the head with clubs. All right, you ready to go for the last one?
Yes.
Here's your last less-than-wise statement.
With me, you get two for the price of one.
That was someone back in 1992 telling the voters of America that they could expect an extra special bonus if they elected him. Who came to regret that promise?
92?
Yes.
It wasn't Ross Perot, was it?
Well, that was, in his case, it was two personalities, but you're wrong.
Not quite, no. Same contest.
Bill Clinton.
Yes. For some reason, Mr. Clinton assumed...
Talk about your Democratic whatchamacallits, by the way. Yeah.
For some reason, Mr. Clinton assumed that the American people would be happy to have a first lady who governed along with him as a sort of unelected co-conspirator. His habit, though, of assigning his wife Hillary Clinton to key government jobs did not endear her to much of the public, so after some early missteps, she quickly withdrew to the traditional first lady's duties of social hosting, charitable works, and plotting her ascension to power in her own right. Carl, how did Britt do in our quiz?
Well, the intern performed like a fully ordained minister, Peter. She had three correct answers, so Britt, you win our prize.
Very well done. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Just the two of us. We can make it if we try. Just the two of us. Just the two of us.
We're going to be looking for another listener to join us to play our Bluff the Listener game in just a few minutes. Call 1-888-WAIT-WAIT. To take your shot at our prize. Right now, panel, though, some questions for you. All of your questions at this point in our game have to do with the alleged wisdom of our founding fathers. Roy, John Quincy Adams was an ambassador, a U.S. senator, one of our most brilliant secretaries of state, and finally himself the sixth president of these United States. But above and beyond all of these accomplishments, during the early 19th century, his own name, Quincy, became a synonym for what?
This jelly tastes a little quincy, people would say. Quincy? I mean, why would his middle name become a synonym?
Well, because it presumably would be John Adams if you referred to it as
right,
a John.
Because John was already a synonym.
Well, actually, oddly enough, that's one of the ironies of the story.
Aha.
Aha.
It's a potty joke of some sort.
It is, in fact.
I should have known. Well, let's see.
That's where we go first in this show.
There you go.
And then downhill.
A Quincy then was a sort of convenience, public convenience.
Yes, it was. It was a flush toilet, which was, of course, a huge novelty at the time.
Yeah.
In those days. And the story is that Mr. Adams had the first such device installed in the White House.
Oh.
And it was so amazing, such a wonder, that for a while, people referred to these things as Quincy's on the off chance that they would come across one. Interestingly enough, although Mr. Adams did, in fact, have a Quincy, he did not have a bathtub. He used to, every morning, go skinny dipping in the Potomac River. He'd walk out, go skinny dipping, and one morning, according to the story, somebody stole his clothes.
Mm-hmm. And that actually literally led to that expression. You know, when you say you stole somebody's issue, you stole their clothes. They say that in Washington.
Really?
Yeah.
If all those stories are true, he spent much of his 8 years as president naked.
Yeah. Yeah. On the Quincy. Where's the president? Well, you know the president.
He's in the water closet, being redundant.
Yeah.
Roxanne, Benjamin Franklin, a scientist and inventor, one of the founders of our country. He was also an important chronicler of American language. He is credited with recording more than 228 different words and phrases, all used to describe one single thing. What?
Let's think. He liked women.
He did.
I know. He liked food.
He did?
He...
You're working your way up the pyramid of necessities. You're going to arrive at it at a moment.
Sex? No.
No, that would be, for him at least, the first thing.
Okay. All right. Money, printing, electricity.
Without this important collection of language, we would not be able to describe fraternity parties to this day.
Drunkenness.
Yes. Okay. 228 different phrases and words for drunkenness. Phrases and words.
I have been all of them, by the way.
I'm sure. Phrases and words such as crump-footed, pigeon-eyed, generous, glazed, got the glanders, globular, had a thump over the head with Samson's jawbone, and of course my particular favorite, womble-cropped.
Ooh. And Quincy hugging.
From NPR and Chicago Public Radio, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Carl Castle. We're playing this week with Charlie Pierce, Roxanne Roberts, and Roy Blunt, Jr. And here again is your host at Memorial Hall on the campus of the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, Carl. And thank you all. All right now it is time for the Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me Bluff the Listener game. Call 1-888-WAIT-WAIT if you'd like to play our games on the air. Hi, you're on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Hi, Peter. This is Jim from South Burlington, Vermont.
Hey, Jim, how are you?
I'm very well. Yourself?
I'm fine. Well, what do you do there in South Burlington?
Well, I'm a police officer in a neighboring community and an author.
An author?
An author.
What do you write about?
Well, believe it or not, I write history books.
Do you really?
Really.
That doesn't seem fair somehow. Jim, it's very nice to have you with us. Now, you're going to play the game in which you must try to tell truth from fiction. Carl, what is Jim's topic?
Colonial Williamsburg is so yesterday.
Since we don't have time machines, the next best thing are these living history museums. But watching some actress churn butter or some IT guy dressed up like Lord Darkblade of Dorkwad at the Renaissance Fair, it just gets old, if you'd excuse the expression. So our panelists are going to tell you about three remarkable new proposals for living history museums we've heard, where you'll be able to experience a time and place that we didn't know that people would pay money to experience. Only one of them has actually been proposed, though. Your job is to pick the real one. Ready to play?
I'm sure all three will be great.
Well, here we go. The first story comes from Charlie Pierce.
Hey, Vladislav, you've just won the Ukrainian National Vodka Swilling Contest. What are you going to do next? I'm going to Gulag World! Igor Shpetkov, the mayor of Vorkuta, an old coal town in the Siberian Arctic, has announced that he would be recapturing the town's history as a slave labor camp in what he calls an effort in extreme tourism. Tourists attending his mock labor camp will get the full Stalinist experience, including bad food, wooden bunk beds, and guard dogs. Americans can stay here, Mayor Shpetkov said. We will give them a chance to escape.
You've read the Gulag Archipelago, now you can live it.
Nice.
At a Gulag vacation camp. Your next story of a package tour to the past comes from Roy Blunt, Jr.
In 1947, D.W. Washburn of Roanoke, Virginia, suffered what is known as a lying-in-the-road death. Having drunk too much on a cold night, he lay on the warm asphalt and was run over. This was not at all like him. To preserve his memory in the proper light, his descendants have turned his home into the D.W. Washburn Bed, Breakfast, and Museum. For $68, you can spend the night surrounded by portraits of and tributes to Armistead as prominent attorney, legislator, and commentator on the Book of Ruth, and by his extensive collection of stuffed squirrels. For $100 more, you can wear his clothes and pretend to be him. At 8 p.m. in his smoking jacket, you may feel transported to a more gracious time. At midnight, in his pajamas, you may long for the highway.
A chance to not only visit a certain gentleman's home, but to become him. And your last story of a place where the future never happened comes from Roxanne Roberts.
Tourists to Versailles, France, now have an alternative to the grandeur of the famous palace. Historian Jacques Letourneau created the 1789 experience, which allows visitors to live the last 3 hours of a French aristocrat during the Revolution. Letourneau has converted a farm outside the small town into a historically accurate 18th century prison and execution ground. For 100 euros, tourists are dressed in heavy period clothing and housed in a Spartan cell where a citizen repeats their biography and charges against them. A priest hears their last confession, a servant serves a last glass of wine, and they are then stripped to a dressing gown and forced to climb the steps of a guillotine. The experience ends when the guillotine drops, which is rigged to fall without actually harming the participants.
It was the best of times, it was the worst of times. It can all be yours for 200 euros. All right, let's review your choices, Jim. From Charlie Pierce, the story of a man who wants to set up a site of an old gulag as a historical tourist destination. From Roy Blunt, Jr., the story of a particular inn where not only do you get to enjoy a gentleman's possessions, you get to act as if you were he. And from Roxanne Roberts, a chance for anyone to pretend they were a aristocrat in the French Revolution in the tumbril going to their death. What fun. Which of these is a real story of a proposed historical reenactment for tourists?
I don't know. You had me going with the one in Virginia there until you mentioned the French.
Really?
Yeah, they'll do anything.
All right, so are you then choosing? You're going to choose Roxanne's story? You're going to be...
I'll regret this probably if I'm wrong. My wife, you know, we bought a new answering machine and everything.
Oh. Counting your Carls before the hatch. You're going to go with the French. You're going to go with Roxanne's story of a chance to be executed.
I'd go.
In the reign of terror. Well, things must be bleak in Vermont. All right. Your choice then is Roxanne's story of a recreation of the reign of terror with you being the terrified. Well, to bring you the real story, we spoke to a historian who is eminently familiar with the real thing.
It's very hard to imagine anybody wanting to go to a gulag museum in which you were allegedly living like people lived in the gulag. That would presumably mean having them live in temperatures at minus 50 degrees with no boots and so on. I didn't see it working.
That was Anne Applebaum, author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book Gulag, A History, being vaguely appalled at the prospect of setting up a new gulag as a tourist destination, which has, in fact, been proposed for this town in Siberia. I'm so sorry, but as you now know, Charlie had the right answer.
I'm crushed.
I'm so sorry, Jim, but in fact, you did not win our game. But you did earn a point for Roxanne.
That's the next best thing.
And what's interesting to me is Roxanne said to me before the show, she told me what it was going to be, and she said, you know, I'd go if this were real. Roxanne, you found your soulmate.
I absolutely would go. I would be fascinated.
I'll check the airfares.
Good luck, and if anybody sets this up having heard this show, well then, I'm sure you guys will be first in line. Thank you so much for calling us, Jim.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye. And now the game where we reward a lifetime of achievement with a few moments of confusion. It's the game we call Not My Job. Novelist Clyde Edgerton was born in North Carolina and except for 5 years has lived here his whole life. Now those 5 years he spent in the employ of the United States government flying jets in Vietnam and elsewhere. His most recent book, a memoir, is called Solo. It's a celebration of the joy of flying and even on a few occasions, the joy of dropping straight toward the ground. Clyde Edgerton, welcome to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Thank you, Peter. It's nice to be here.
Nice to have you.
Thank you.
Now, you say in your book that you first became interested in flying when your mother took you to see some airplanes right here in Raleigh.
That happened when I was about 4 years old. She was the kind of type to get me out of the house and show me things. And so she took me to the airport, which was just one little runway at the time. And a couple of years later, she took me to see the electric chair, actually, in Raleigh. And it wasn't a science trip. It was a trip about morals and so forth. And so that doesn't have a lot to do with airplanes, but...
Well, it's just you came that close to growing up to be an executioner, I guess.
That's right.
So. Why in the world would she take you to see the electric... At what age?
I think I was about six. I learned that it wasn't... not that it makes any difference, but it wasn't an electric chair. It was actually a chair in the gas chamber in Central Prison in Raleigh.
And what a letdown.
Okay, I got a number of questions about that. First of all, they let six-year-olds into the prison to see the gas chamber?
Actually, I remember standing up on a little stool. There was a little window about the size of a loaf of bread that you could look through and you could see the chair. And I told an interviewer about it because I used a character in a novel, and this happened to the character in the novel, and that my mother had taken me, and someone called her and said, "You didn't take him, you took the whole Sunday school class." And so then when I was on tour, I would ask people in the audience, how many people have a mother who took them to see the electric chair? I was in Portland, Oregon, and I asked the question, and four people raised their hand. One was from North Carolina, one from South Carolina, one from Georgia, and one from Mississippi. And the guy from Mississippi raised his hand. He said, "In Mississippi, we had a portable electric chair that they took around to the elementary schools." So.
In those four states, when they instituted that policy, the rate of six-year-olds murdering people went way down.
Yes.
So anyway, that didn't take, but the airplane did, and you became a pilot. You became, in fact, an Air Force pilot.
Right.
And you enjoyed yourself.
I did. I sort of I looked forward to, I dreamed about flying when I was small, and then I would watch these films when TV went off at midnight with an F-104 doing aileron rolls and the poem High Flight and the National Anthem. And this was right after World War I, World War II, so it was honorable to serve your country. And so I was ready to go when I came to school here in 1962. And I was in ROTC for 4 years and then in the Air Force for 5 years.
Wow. But you're not flying anymore.
I haven't flown since 91. And when I crashed the airplane I owned at that time.
Really?
Yeah. No one was hurt. It was a sort of a simple little tip over on the nose and over on the top.
But you walked away and that was it?
That was it.
Right.
One little quick story about the crash.
Oh, sure, please.
Many people here know Tim McLaurin, who's a writer. He was a good friend of mine, and he and I flew together quite often. When I crashed my airplane, which totaled the airplane, the night that happened, I started calling my friends, and saying, "I crashed my airplane." And then they would say, "Oh, gosh, you okay? Is the airplane okay? Are you all right?" Call another friend, "Are you all right?" "Yes." Another friend, "Are you okay?" "Yes." I called Tim. I said, "Tim, I crashed my airplane today." And he said, "Damn, I wish I'd been with you."
Well, Clyde Edgerton, we're happy to have you with us. We've invited you here to play a game we're calling...
"Of course you can trust me. I'm a doctor."
Mm-hmm. You might think that going to the doctor now is a pain, what with the insurance and the cost of drugs. On the other hand, these days, you at least have a decent chance of not being killed. We're going to ask you three questions about medical treatments of the past, brought to our attention by a wonderful institution known as the Museum of Questionable Medical Devices. A real place in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Get two of these questions right. You'll win a prize for one of our listeners, Carl's Voice, under their home answering machine. You ready to play?
Ready.
Okay, here we go. Carl, who is Clyde Edgerton playing for?
Peter, he's playing for Kevin Trapani of Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
All right, sir. Here's your first question. Which of these was a medical device you could have purchased in 1918 made possible by the modern miracle of electricity? A, the intra-ear brain massager. B, the do-it-yourself home companion bone saw. Or C, the prostate gland warmer.
So, should I say what I would like to have been invented? Or?
Follow your bliss, Clyde. That's what I'm saying.
So, panel, can you help me out a little bit?
You're getting warm, I think.
Okay. I'll say C.
The prostate gland warmer. You're right. Merely plug it in and insert.
Whoa.
And if that sounded too delicate for those suffering from maladies back in that era, they could also turn to the much feared rectorotor. All right, next question. Now, you may think that this sort of thing has faded away, but no, it's continued through the years. In 1976, for example, more than 4 million people laid out about $10 to buy what? A, the foot-operated breast enlarger pump. B, the power-off pimple disc sander. Or C, the pure carbon aura cleansing brush.
The aura cleansing?
Yeah, you know, an aura being the field around you that you're supposed to exude, according to some theories of the spirit, and you, this presumably you brush to cleanse it, your aura.
What year was
this? This would be 1976.
C.
C. You're going to go for the aura.
C.
No, it was the breast enlarger pump.
Mm. Oh.
Pretty much what you would expect. Foot-operated pump.
What do you do with your hands while you're using it? Why would you? I don't know.
Here's your last question. So now you're 1 for 2. If you get this last one, you'll win.
Oh.
All right, so here we go. People are still making money selling this sort of thing. For example, as recently as 1996, you could buy a Crystaldyne pain reliever. What, in reality, is a Crystaldyne pain reliever? Is it A, a repackaged surplus pet rock from the 1970s? B, a gas grill igniter with a little handle on it? Or C, a plastic pyramid you wear on your head?
Jesus. I don't know what the gas grill has to do with pain. I mean, that seems, we can rule out number, letter B.
Yeah.
So we'll go with
C. If it's a pet, the pet rocks, if crystalline, is that a hint? Was it
pet
a clear
rocks
rock?
Pet rocks weren't crystal.
No,
they were just
they're
kind
granite.
Of
yeah. They were granite.
Yeah.
So. I mean, I'm tempted to go with the, I would go with the
I had a pet rock
that
grew
wore.
Vicious and we had to put it back in the woods.
But Clyde, the time has come, the moment of truth, you must choose.
C.
C, you're going to choose the plastic pyramid you put in your head. Yes?
Yes.
No, it was the gas grill igniter.
Oh, in the medical?
Well, you know, it's a little thing in your gas grill, if you happen to have a gas grill. You press it, it makes a little electric spark that lights the grill.
Yeah.
Well, if you take one of those things and you put it up against your skin and you push the button,
It
will, quote, cure headaches, back pain, arthritis, stress, menstrual cramps, earaches, sinus, nosebleeds, flu, and other ailments, unquote.
Yes, because instead of saying, oh, I have a headache, you say, oh, my arm is on fire.
Right. Pretty much. It's the misdirection school
yes.
of medicine. Carl, how did Clyde Edgerton do in our quiz?
Clyde needed 2 correct answers to win, Peter, at least 2. He had just 1 correct answer, so.
Oh, I'm sorry, sir. And that guy you were playing for, very important man. Mm. You're in trouble now.
Well, I've got a prostate warmer to sell him.
Clyde Edgerton is the author of many acclaimed novels and the recent memoir, Solo. He's also a professor of writing at the University of North Carolina in Wilmington. Clyde Edgerton, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
NPR and Chicago Public Radio, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Carl Castle. We're playing this week with Roxanne Roberts, Charlie Pierce, and Roy Blunt Jr. And here again is your host at Memorial Hall on the campus of the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, Peter Sagal.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, everybody. Now, in just a minute, Carl will astound you with his creative use of language in our listener limerick challenge. Call 1-888-WAIT-WAIT to join us on the air. But first, panel, back to you. Some more questions for you. And all of your questions this time are about pioneers in a variety of different fields. Roy.
Yeah.
Nowadays, people go on about the undaunted courage and such of Captains Lewis and Clark. Mm-hmm. But in the 19th century, at the time of their expedition, nobody really thought it was that big a deal. It wasn't that impressive. Mm. For example, on one occasion, Lewis recorded in his journal an attack by hostile natives. But it turns out it was just what?
Lewis recorded this?
Yes.
He said, was Clark.
Actually, you're close.
Oh, it was their guys who were carrying things who woke up too early in the morning?
No.
No. Well, it seemed possible. I mean, by that I meant their bearers or whatever.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. You're on the right track.
I'm on the right track.
You know what? I'm going to give it to you.
Oh, thank you.
Because you're so close.
Good.
And I'm going to give him a...
Good.
What happened was one of his own soldiers accidentally shot him in the rear.
Oh, I see.
Thank you.
I see. Well...
Private Pierre Cruzet, a member of the expedition, was an expert with a fiddle. He could speak,
but not with a gun.
But not with a gun. Well, that was the problem. He was a useful guy. He spoke the language of the Omaha Indian tribe. He had a lot of skills, but he only had one eye. So he probably wasn't the best guy to send elk hunting that morning.
Yeah.
And he kind of saw out of the corner of his one eye this slow-moving object and shot it, getting his commanding officer in what was delicately called the left thigh.
Uh-huh.
Roxanne, consider, if you will, the classic American breakfast of bacon and eggs. Standing behind this hearty morning meal is a towering intellectual pioneer. Who is the great mind responsible for us all eating bacon and eggs?
Is it a real intellectual?
It's a real intellectual. I'm not being facetious.
All right.
So it's not Bob Evans?
No, nor is it Jimmy Dean.
How about Stuckey, the famous Greek philosopher?
Denny
and Stuckey.
20th century?
Yes.
20th century.
Well, you rule out everybody Jewish, and that narrows it pretty good. There are only five guys and three women.
Actually, ironically, one of the many ironies of this story is that he was Jewish.
Einstein?
No. I was just thinking about that.
It's his famous theory of omelet. No.
He might have explained as a hint that we eat the bacon out of unconscious aggression toward the pig.
Ooh.
Freud?
Yes. Sigmund Freud is the reason we eat bacon and eggs for breakfast.
But he'd tell you sex was the reason we ate bacon and eggs.
Well, look it. Eggs over easy.
That's right.
That's true. And let's not even get into the sausage, okay?
Yeah.
No, this is one of the most amazing... And,
Peter, sometimes a sausage is just sausage.
Yeah. This is an amazing story, a true story of intellectual history. It turns out that one of the great doctor's nephews emigrated to America and became one of the pioneers in public relations. His name was Edward Bernays. And he got the job...
Bernays?
Bernays, as in... Yes, he then went on to create Bernays sauce. No, he did not. He was a PR guy, and he got this job from a company that made bacon. And they said, we want you to increase sales of bacon. And he thought about his uncle's theories, which his uncle had explained to him on hikes in the Viennese countryside. And he realized...
Well, it must have been fun going with Uncle Sigmund, huh?
Yeah. And he decided, in order to sell bacon, he would appeal to man's unconscious desire for physical well-being. So he started selling bacon, which people didn't really eat for breakfast, as a way to ensure your physical health and vitality and hold off the dark specter of death. And it worked, and that's why we eat bacon and eggs for breakfast.
Huh. But it didn't hold off the dark specter of death.
Well, no.
No. In fact, it hastened it for many people.
Coming up, it's lightning fill in the blank, but first it's our listener limerick challenge. If you'd like to play on air, call or leave a message at 1-888-WAIT-WAIT. That's 1-888-924-8924. Hi, you're on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Hi, this is Rex from Kirkland, Washington.
Hey, how are you, Rex?
I'm doing well, thank you.
And what's up in Kirkland?
Out my back window, I get to see the Seahawks practice field.
Really? How
not as impressive as you would think. People seem to be more interested to find out the Seagulls practice Tuesday and Thursday from 6 to 9.
Ah, that would be the cheerleaders.
Yes.
I see. Then you can sell tickets to your living room, I'm sure.
Actually, they ruled that out in our very lease.
Did they really?
Yeah.
What, they said that in your lease you can't charge admission to come and gape at the cheerleaders?
Well, it's to watch the Seahawks. I don't know what it says about the cheerleaders.
Dude, uh-huh. We found you a loophole.
Yeah.
All right, Rex, welcome to the show. Now, Carl Castle is going to read you three limericks with the last word or phrase missing from each. If you can fill in that last word or phrase correctly, and just two of the limericks will be a winner.
All right.
Now, in our special edition this week, your limericks are all about the unlikely inventors of some very familiar items. You ready to play?
Okay.
All right, here we go. Here's your first limerick.
Because Jefferson's old kitchen wench tries, the guests at the dining hall bench rise. With this new dish we're spoiled. What's this? Spuds cooked in oil? It is Jefferson's brand new dish.
It wouldn't be American fries, I'm guessing.
No.
French fries?
Yes, it is. Sure. Sure. Very good. Thomas Jefferson authored the Declaration of Independence, but his real gift to America was the French fry. Until Jefferson served thinly sliced fried potatoes at a White House dinner in 1802, everybody here in the colonies only ate potatoes boiled into mush because they thought otherwise the potatoes would be poisonous. Huh. Not everyone was an immediate fan of the new delicacy. John Adams, for example, thought Jefferson was, quote, putting on airs by serving such novelties.
This is from a man whose kid invented the Quincy.
All right, very good. Here is your next limerick.
Thoreau's mind, like his hands, was prehensile, so he thought up a desktop utensil. His graphite stick bled, so he went to his shed and perfected the non-smear lead.
Pencil?
Yes. Very good. It's true, as the philosopher of Walden Pond wrote, that most men lead lives of quiet desperation, but not Henry David Thoreau himself. Why not? Because he invented the pencil. He worked at his father's graphite pencil company as a young man. The product was faulty, smeared easily. It was Henry David himself who perfected the modern graphite recipe.
Where would the SAT be without him?
Exactly. Yeah. It makes me feel so small and unaccomplished. Here is your last limerick.
Santa Anna, that chewing looks dumb. It's just one step from sucking your thumb. All right, give me a try. This is great. Oh, my. I might sell this stuff, call it.
One more try.
All right.
Santa Anna, that chewing looks dumb. It's just one step from sucking your thumb. All right, give me a try. This is great. Oh, my. I might sell this stuff, call it.
He gave us gum?
He did. He gave us so much. This is, of course, the Mexican president and General Santa Anna, who also gave us Texas by losing a war. Afterwards, he was living in exile on Staten Island, of all places. 1860, he partnered with a man named Thomas Adams to import chicle, this gummy substance you find in trees in South America. They were going to make some kind of rubber for tires or something. They collected all the stuff, and Santa Anna went back to Mexico to become dictator for life. The job opened up. He went. And this guy Adams was stuck with this warehouse filled with useless, aging, gummy stuff. And then he saw a child walking down the street, chewing on a piece of wax, and history was changed. Carl, how did Rex do in our quiz?
Very well, Peter. Perfection is the game for him. Three correct answers. Rex, you win our prize.
Very good.
I look forward to it.
As well you should. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Now it's time to move on to our final game, Lightning Fill in the Blank. Each of our players has 60 seconds in which to answer as many fill-in-the-blank questions as he or she can. Each correct answer now worth 2 points. Carl, can you give us the scores?
Roxanne Roberts has the lead, Peter. She has 3 points. Roy Blunt Jr. and Charlie Pierce each has 2.
We have flipped a coin. Roy has elected to go first. Here you go, Roy. Now, all of your questions are about great outlaws in history.
Oh, good.
clock will start when I begin your first question. Bank robber George Nelson's youthful appearance earned him the nickname Blank.
Babyface.
Right. While he was hanging a picture in his living room, Train and bank robber Blank was shot in the back.
Jesse James, yeah. The dirty little coward that shot Mr. Howard. Played poor Jesse in his grave.
Yes. In a 1969 film, Paul Newman portrayed Blank, the gentleman bandit, who claimed he never killed anyone.
Butch Cassidy.
Right. Because he so much relied on a certain car for his getaways, gangster Clyde Barrow once wrote a thank you note to Blank.
Oh, I'm not sure, but I'll say Ford.
Yes, Henry Good. Ford. When asked why he robbed banks, famous thief Willie Sutton said, because Blank.
That's where the money is.
Yes. Though they may once have been friends, in 1881, Sheriff Pat Garrett became known as the man who shot Blank.
Billy the Kid.
Yes. Notorious 1930s-era gangster Machine Gun Kelly acquired his nickname because Blank.
He was really good at doing a machine gun imitation.
No.
No, I don't know.
He did it because his wife made him.
Made him carry a machine gun to protect himself?
No, made him walk around and call himself Machine Gun
Kelly. Oh, really?
Yeah. He was just a small-time crook and ex-con. When he met Catherine Thorne, they fell madly in love.
Huh.
And she came up with this brilliant marketing campaign for him. She bought him a machine gun, made him practice how to use it, started giving people little souvenirs, used shell cases, she said, came from the feared outlaw Machine Gun Kelly. Sadly, even though he was much feared, he was also much hungover when the FBI finally came for him, and he gave himself up without a fight.
Behind every great man.
Yep. At the time, criminals felt they needed a marketing campaign.
Yeah, well, that was a problem. Yeah. These days, of course, you can be a criminal for carrying your nail file to the airport.
Yeah,
so.
And nail file Kelly just doesn't have the same ring to it, does it?
Yeah, it's taken a whole lot away from being a criminal.
Knitting Needle McGraw.
Are there?
Carl, how did Roy do in our quiz?
Roy had 6 correct answers for 12 more points. He now has 14 points, and Roy has the lead.
All right, very good. All right, Charlie, all of your questions this time are about fictional detectives.
Ah.
Fill in the blank. Arthur Conan Doyle, tired of writing about his popular detective Blank, tried to kill him off in a story called The Final Problem.
That would be Sherlock Holmes.
Yes.
Falling down Reichenbach Falls.
You bet. Hercule Poirot and Miss Marple were 2 of author Blank's most popular detectives.
Agatha Christie.
Right. Before Peter Falk made the trench coat-wearing TV detective his own, Bing Crosby turned down the role of Blank.
Columbo?
Yes. Many believe that the modern detective story was invented by Blank in his stories The Murders in the Rue Morgue and The Purloined Letter.
Edgar Allan Poe.
Yes. Humphrey Bogart created the model for the hard-boiled detective in the 3rd movie version of the Dashiell Hammett novel Blank.
The Maltese Falcon.
Yes. Raymond Chandler's first Philip Marlowe novel, The Big Sleep, was adapted to the screen by Nobel Prize-winning author Blank.
Oh, I get this one. William Faulkner!
Yes! In the original version of her second book, heroine Blank packs a pistol, trespasses, breaks into a house, and on one occasion almost shoots a maid.
V.I. Warshawski.
No, Nancy Drew. The Nancy Drew that young women originally
Nancy
read
Drew
about.
Nancy Drew was packing?
She was. This was the great thing.
Really?
In the original versions of the novel, back in the late 40s, early 50s, she was a little more self-reliant and less concerned with the niceties of the law. But
Nancy Drew and 3 men died.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, in one of the early books, she shot one of the Hardy Boys just to watch him die. Carl, how did Charlie do in our quiz?
Charlie had 6 correct answers for 12 more points. He now has 14 and has tied Roy for the lead.
All right. It all comes down to this. How many does Roxanne need to win?
6 correct answers.
6 correct answers. All right, Roxanne, here we go. All of your questions will be about big career breaks. Okay? Here we go. Fill in the blank. Legend has it that actress Lana Turner was discovered while sitting in a blank on Hollywood Boulevard.
A drugstore, Schwab's.
Yeah, Schwab's drugstore, soda fountain. Vivian Leigh won the lead in Blank when she met producer David Selznick after he was already filming The Burning of Atlanta.
Gone with the Wind.
Yes.
Yes.
Annette Funicello, Britney Spears, Christina Aguilera, and Justin Timberlake all got their starts in the TV show Blank.
The Musketeers.
The Mickey Mouse Club, yes. Good enough. Yeah. When Yankees first baseman Wally Pipp decided to sit out a game, he inadvertently made way for the 2,130 consecutive games played by Blank.
Lou Gehrig.
Right, Lou Gehrig. After her picture was shown on the stadium screen at a football game in Canada, Labatt's Beer hired Busty Beauty Blank for their commercials.
Busty Beauty. Jane Mansfield?
No, Pam Anderson. Thought her career
got
started.
She's Canadian?
She is. Although his first big role was the dead friend in the hit movie The Big Chill, all of Blank's scenes were ultimately cut from the film.
Was that Kevin Costner?
It was Kevin Costner. Vincent Price said he was cast in his first theatrical role because of his ability to blank.
Play dead.
No, talk and chew gum at the same time. Quite literally. He was the son of a candy maker. He was living in Britain in 1934 when he was cast in a production of a new play called Chicago. Chewing gum was virtually unknown in Britain, but it was done in America, so they wanted the characters to chew gum. Nobody knew how to do it. In fact, he was so good at chewing gum and talking that he ended up teaching the rest of the cast to do it, and a career was born.
Bobby Dunn.
Carl, did Roxanne do well enough to win?
Peter, she needed 6 correct answers to win. She had just 5. So Roy Blunt Jr. and Charlie Pierce are this week's co-champions.
Congratulations. Now, panel, what will be the most important invention of the 21st century? Charlie Pierce.
Yet another foolproof plumbing device named for a president who is the son of a president. Yes! It's the George. Pull the chain and almost everything goes down the drain.
Roxanne Roberts.
The Microsoft Cell Zapper, which automatically ends any public cell phone call within 10 feet of another person.
And Roy Blunt Jr.
The stick. In the year 2094, by our calendar, which unfortunately won't apply anymore, a particularly adroit and imaginative cockroach will be crawling through the rubble and ash and come upon a long, straight thing and think, hey, with this, I could really poke around through the rubble.
Well, if any of those inventions become a reality panel, hopefully we'll be here to tell you about it on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Thank you, Carl Castle. Thanks also to Roy Blunt Jr., Charlie Pierce, and Roxanne Roberts. And thanks to all of you for listening. I am Peter Sagal. We will see you next week. This is NPR, National Public Radio.